Federal News Radio's Federal Chief Financial Officer Survey for 2014, and we'll introduce our special guest in just a moment. Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller is here first and set the scene for us with this survey as we do these on an ongoing basis, Jason.
Right. This is part of our annual survey, our CXO survey. We've done Chief Human Capital, we've done Chief Acquisition Officer, and now it's time for the CFO survey. So a lot of improper payments, internal controls, fun, exhilarating stuff like that. And this survey actually is a little different this year, only in the sense that we didn't have to deal with the fact of sequestration and budget cuts and potential government shutdown. We know now that there is no government shutdown happening, at least in the short term, which is probably good news for our guest and yes, everybody else in the federal community. But the reaction we got was good from the survey. We got about 62, almost 63% of the respondents were from cabinet-level agencies. The rest were from large or small agencies. All were career employees. And we got a nice split between CFOs and deputy CFOs in terms of who were the respondents. So it gives us a sense of not just the top level, but the next level down as well. This survey, nothing really jumped out at me as overly surprising. I think a lot of the same issues that came up last time we did this came up this time, and we're going to get into those results in just a second.
Marty Rubenstein is the Chief Financial Officer at the National Science Foundation. Marty, thank you very much for being here today. It's great to talk to you. What, as you looked at these questions and then the answers, anything in particular that struck you as particularly noteworthy, important, surprising, anything like that?
Actually, nothing was very surprising. It seems to me it's all the same issues we've been dealing with for the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. The new issues that are coming across, I guess the main one that Jason mentioned, is you have a little bit of certainty about what things will look like, at least through December 11th right now.
Right, which is when you set aside last year's shutdown, then really having a CR is business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, we're very relieved that we have it so soon in a way that it's not September 30th and we're already figuring out how we're going to manage through December 11th.
Mm-hmm.
Does that change when you guys start doing your budget planning? And I know you're into 16 already. They're due to OMB probably any day now, or they already sent?
No, it was already gone.
Yeah, which is good.
Yes.
I guess. But when you, does that change knowing that you have a CR and you're at least down the same path through December 11th? Does that change your role at all or what you do?
It just takes one issue off a plate and something out of my mind that I don't have to worry about is really all it does. And that we'll have to worry about it starting in December to figure out what the next stage is. Are we going to get funding through the rest of the year, or is it going to be, you know, constant stopgaps?
What are your top priorities for the rest of this fiscal year and into next fiscal year?
Well, that's really easy for me because we're in the throes of bringing up a new financial system. So on October 1st, for fiscal 15, we kick it off with our new system, iTrack. So it's been something we've planned for 3 years. We've been doing a 2-year implementation. So really my entire life has coalesced around bringing that system up. And we plan to go absolutely live and back to regular operations on October 14th.
How has that process developed? What methodologies did you use to bring that online, the procurement process, all that kind of stuff?
We followed all the OMB guidance and GAO requirements. So I think we've done a really good job of doing exactly what supposedly the best practices are.
Mm-hmm.
We went out to a lot of agencies and looked for all their lessons learned, and we spent multiple years cleaning up our data because we have decades and decades of financial data, and people told us that was one of the biggest problems. If you don't clean up your data and you try to carry over too much, you make a big mess. Another major thing is the change management of bringing the organization along and getting people to adapt the new system. So we're in the throes of doing training right now, mm-hmm. and really we won't know how that comes about until, of course, we're up and running.
How has the response been so far, though? Because change management, I hear all the time, is one of, if not the biggest, difficulty in making a transition.
It
like
is
this.
Difficult. I think we're lucky NSF is a fairly small organization, and hopefully, to some extent, the change, if it goes well, will be transparent to a lot of end users because they'll be using feeder systems to the financial system.
Mm-hmm.
But we're still out there talking to everybody. We have change champions in every organization, and we've been spending the last year really making a major press to get people to understand what's going to be happening.
One of the things you hear a lot about when it comes to financial system modernizations is did you change your processes or did you change the software to fit your processes?
We changed the processes.
I knew that was a softball.
So, yes. So, and it's very hard for me because I did systems development starting back in the 80s, and I have my master's in information systems. And when I was taking classes, it was all about reengineering processes, but making the system accommodate the user. And so it was a real switch for me to move my head around to the idea that nowadays, in order to use the software appropriately, use their internal controls, and not spend too much money, you have to adapt to the system and to the software. And that was a big deal.
How big of an adaptation was it? Because I think one thing that's fascinating is they talk about gaps. You look at your processes, you look at what the system can do, and you say, well, there's 10 gaps or 50 gaps or whatever the number is. Did you find that the software is meeting most of your needs, some of your needs? How would you rate it?
Most of our needs. Most of our needs. And again, you know, a lot of people are going to be going through the feeder system, so their interaction will be mitigated somewhat. I think, and until it's really up and running, I don't know where those gaps are going to be or how hard it is going to be for people to use it. I can tell you one fundamental thing is that the software calls every kind of sort of like obligation or item a requisition or something, whereas we're used to seeing in our systems awards and grants. And so just the psychology of that one, you know, change name is going to be hard for people, I think.
You used a term a couple of minutes ago that I think is really cool, change champions. What are they? Who are they? What do they do?
We went out to all the program areas and got people to volunteer. And so from the very beginning, for the last 2 years, they've come to meetings, they've participated in understanding how the software is configured, how it's going to work, and trying to take that message back to their organizations so that we have everybody involved.
Mm-hmm. And was it hard to recruit them, or did you find people scattered throughout the organization who were early adopters, ready to buy in early on and get involved?
It's a mix. Mm-hmm. We had to go and remind several programs that we needed people. But the whole idea of early adopters is something we've learned recently. So once the system's up, we're going to be out there seeing who really quickly adapts to it, knows how to use it, and then use them to help train and motivate others to use the system.
Mm-hmm.
Just a couple weeks ago, we're still doing lessons learned and trying to understand from other agencies. So we had a panel, and we brought in the former CFO of Department of Labor, the current deputy at OPM, and the FBI CIO, CFO, all of whom have done systems recently. And so they came to talk to senior leadership to talk about change management and how leaders need to be there to help mitigate issues and move the organization along. And so we're constantly still learning, trying to do this the best
way
we can.
That's a really cool idea. Were there common themes among what each of them had to share with your
folks?
Don't
blame the CFO. Which is a message I wanted others to hear.
I bet.
Even though I do take full responsibility for the success or failure of the system. But it was a lot about don't let people, listen to them, help them through their angst, but don't allow an individual or a couple individuals to derail the system. So if because they've used the incorrect, say, data code string to try to put something into the system and the system won't accept it, having them run off down the hall saying, well, it doesn't work, mm-hmm. the system's down, is really the type of negative situation we're going to try to avoid.
And it's striking to me because in a lot of these transitional systems, the very basic principles of change management apply no matter what you're changing. Is that your experience?
Absolutely. And system changes and other things are happening all the time. But this is something fairly large, and we've tried to have a very concerted effort.
So let me ask the monkey in the room here, because shared services, you obviously did not go down that path for shared services, at least that you didn't mention it yet. You probably started down the path before OMB issued the mandate, and to change in midstream probably didn't make sense, both from a cost and a process perspective. But one thing that came across from our survey was when we asked about shared services and how likely are you to move in the next 5 years, a majority said, 62% said they're not likely at all, which I thought that was a little surprised. Did you guys have to justify the path you went down, or because you were heading down that path already, there was no justification needed?
Both. We were pretty far down the path, and we still had to go and talk to OMB about where we were and why we shouldn't change. And it was more than midstream. And they agreed. And so we are the last major agency to do their own financial system. But we're very interested in shared services. I think we're going to need at least a year to stabilize and go through a whole process of a whole year. And then we'll be looking at particular aspects of financial processing and decide, is there something we're able to go to a shared service provider for, because it's not our bread and butter. It's not what we're interested in really spending our resources on.
Why do you think, and again, I don't know, you can't comment on every other CFO, but do you guys talk about CFO council meetings about shared services?
All the time. That's surprising. No.
It's not all about improper payments and internal controls?
No. And right now it's the Data Act.
Yes. Well, that we're going to talk about that later, because okay. There's actually a big issue in the Data Act coming up, a big conference and a big town hall. But just from a shared service perspective, is it just people need to get comfortable with the topic, the idea again? Is that what the biggest barrier?
No, I think it's much more specific. I think it's much more, are the providers in a position financially and technology-wise to bring on additional clientele? And how are service standards being set? And how... It's that, again, it's change management. It's letting go of knowing that that process is happening on the second floor and you can go down there and figure out what's wrong instead of it happening across the city. So it's a mix of different issues that everybody's grappling with.
It's the same thing that we hear from IT people about the cloud and,
yes.
and the fact that I don't have the servers in a location
yes.
I can touch them. They're somewhere.
Yes.
What do you think the biggest keys will be to getting around that?
For shared services?
Yes.
You need a success. You need somebody to step up to the plate, to take another organization on, and for that to be successful, and for them to be transparent about how the costs are developed, you know, what you're paying for, what you're getting, and involving the clients really in deciding what the system's going to provide.
Our annual CFO survey. My colleague Jason Miller is here joining the questioning with Marty Rubenstein, the CFO at the National Science Foundation.
I want to go back to the budget discussion for a second and priorities, specifically your priorities. Now, we talked a lot about that. There's a CR through mid-December, and that gives some stability to the federal community, to CFOs like yourself saying, okay, we know at least what our budget's going to look like for the next, you know, month and a half, 2 months. When we talked to our survey, we asked CFOs what their top priority was. The biggest priority came back was finding efficiencies in your agency in light of sequestration and budget cuts. So even though the budget is stable, it's still shrinking. There's still reductions that everybody has to deal with. Talk about how you, in your role at the NSF, is still looking at that, finding efficiencies in the government from a budget perspective. What's your role in that?
Well, happily, I'm not the only person in the National Science Foundation trying to find efficiencies. I mean, there's a whole, everybody looks at that on a daily basis. I don't see, it's a priority, but not at the top of my list. I think it's something we do every day. There's nothing we take on to do new or different that we're not thinking how to do this most efficiently and with the least amount of resources. So I don't see it as sort of the thing that keeps me awake or that I focus on all the time. Also, to be honest, the National Science Foundation, we do have a lot of strong bipartisan support. So in spite of the sequestration, since 2010, our program budgets have been growing. Now our administrative budgets have been flat or declining. And so that does create pressure for us to keep improving our processes of oversight, for example. So where I spend a lot of my time is thinking, how do I make sure that we're overseeing our grants portfolio in a proper way with limited resources?
So it's good news that your program budget is growing.
Yes. And,
but on the administrative side, I mean, that's where people come to you maybe and say, or you work together through a governance board with your CIO and your assistant secretary for management or whatever the proper term is in NSF. How can we, again, be more efficient in the back office? The financial management system, I think, is one example. I'm sure you're expecting both savings, cost avoidance, and better service. Are there other areas that you play a big role in, whether it's technology or HR or acquisition, that also are looking at efficiencies in the back office area?
Well, yes, but I don't have any specific examples. We're doing a broad spectrum of things, I guess. For example, like a lot of agencies, we're trying to centralize everybody's cell phones, you know, usage and accounts and how many providers do we have and that sort of thing. I think you're going to make bigger savings from the big departments than you are from some size agency like the National Science Foundation. I can't think of anything major going on because, again, it's something constant. And really what it's about for me is it's how do we do less with less? I'm not about doing more with less any longer. And so as continued mandatory requirements come down or we're required to do additional things, we're squeezing things out that we want to be doing as well. And it's all about using risk management to prioritize what things you're going to invest in and take time to do and what you're going to have to put aside, even knowing that you should be doing it.
But that's a realistic decision-making process that we haven't seen in government. That, and I think primarily that's been driven by Congress because this. I'm so happy to hear you say you're off the more with less bandwagon because when you sit and really analyze it, it doesn't make sense. So how has that transition worked though? Because that's another mindset, like we talked about in the first part of our conversation, that you've got to change people. They've heard it so much, I guess, that they have it ingrained that that's what we have to try to do, even if it doesn't, if it's not really possible. So you're giving them some freedom almost to be able to decide to prioritize what are things that we no longer have to do, even if we probably should.
Yes.
What does that look like from a managerial perspective?
Well, for my own organization, it means going out to my staff and saying, you need to think about what you can let go of. And that is hard. People don't want to let go of anything. I think because the things that are probably less important are also the easiest things to do that they've been doing a long time, and mm-hmm. they just can't conceive of not doing that any longer.
Right.
So we actually have been doing sort of a grassroots analysis of ourselves, looking where are we duplicating efforts among our own organizations, and what can we let go of. And I tell people, if you ever have a question about what the priority is, you just need to come and talk to me, and I'll make that decision for you or help you make that decision, and then I'll bear responsibility for what doesn't get done. And then in managing up, I'm very clear with my bosses of the status of the major issues, what we're not going to do and why we're not going to do it, and what the potential downfall of not doing it might be. But I am not going to try to do everything that we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, the managing up part of that seems like potentially the biggest challenge. And I'm not suggesting you've run into any obstacles at NSF, but if someone in your spot is trying to manage up that way and runs into an obstacle, that pretty much puts the kibosh to that idea.
It may seem that way, but the reality is we have finite staffs mm-hmm. with finite time, and we're not going to do it all. So either you make the decision to have a rational way of choosing what to do, or you know, you're going to just be doing a hodgepodge of activities and a lot of things are going to fall through.
One of the things you mentioned was risk management, and I'm hearing that a lot, not just from CIOs, but throughout the government, people are really taking a closer look at risk and how to apply risk. Is there a specific framework or approach you guys are using for risk management? And then what are you looking at? Can you just give us a sense of how you use it? And I know it's a tough question because every instance is a little different, but risk is such an important concept that I think I see growing across the government.
So for years, we've used risk management to decide what institutions or awardees to go and look at, because we have over 40,000 active awards at over 2,200 different awardees. So there's no way we're going to go out and visit all of them, even over the course of a decade. So what we do is we look at different factors associated with those awards to decide, you know, are they a new institution that's never received federal funds? Do they have a lot of our money? Have they had problems in the past? And we decide on an annual basis who we're going to go out and visit and who we're going to do desk audits of. So we've been doing that type of risk analysis for a particular oversight program for years. What we are looking at now is what would an ERM be for budget, finance, and award management, which is my organization. I'm not trying to do it for the National Science Foundation. I want to do it for my own organization. So a couple years ago, we brought in an expert and we had a two-day seminar and educated about a third of the whole organization, more than 50 people, on risk management frameworks. And one of my senior executives has personally taken it on as his own initiative for the organization to try to start to create a framework. So we're in the early stages of that. And to me, the end goal is not to have yet another overlay, but to use it to justify the decisions that we make for the work we will or will not do.
I think that's a very interesting approach. And it's great that you have that senior person who's taken it on, because a lot of times it either falls to someone like yourself, the CFO or the CIO or somebody. From a time frame standpoint, when do you hope to begin, if you will, initial operating capabilities? When do you hope to get it started, say, now we can start applying risk? And it's not that you're not applying it now. I do realize that.
It's a daily decision-making process.
You're right. And it has to be, because every day is going to present you with new challenges and new obstacles. But is it like a Lean Six Sigma where you start training people and they begin using it? Or is it like an ISO 9000 type thing?
That's way too sophisticated. Right now, we're just looking to develop our own framework. What does it mean for us? So we're looking at how can we ensure that our senior management are having the right conversations about what risk means, what's the severity of the risk, and making people understand it from that standpoint. I don't know when. It's going to take us a while. We set ourselves a due date of September 30th this year to try to at least have a draft framework set up. But when you look past, this past year has been hugely challenging. So first, we lost 3 weeks at the beginning of the year with the shutdown, and took us time to come back up. Because of the new financial system, we actually financially closed the agency on September 19th. We are usually obligating funds late on September 30th. So we started back in January and February socializing the entire agency that you're going to have to rationally spend out all of your funds by mid-September instead of the end of the month. So, and then my other highest priority is maintaining our clean financial statement audits. So we've had a clean audit for 16 years. We're one of the top agencies with that record. I would really hate for us to lose that clean opinion on my watch. So bringing up the financial system is number one, keeping a clean audit opinion this year and for the foreseeable future is number two. And while risk management is important to me, it's much further down the list.
What's interesting, I was just going to bring up, because we did actually ask a question about risk management in our survey. And the question was, how much emphasis is your agency placing on risk management as it relates to financial management? And in fact, everyone said either a big emphasis or some emphasis, which I thought was interesting, that the people, that it's really part of their discussion points, really part of their idea. Now, the other question we asked right around this area is, do non-financial managers understand the benefits of internal controls? Now, I know internal controls and risk management are not necessarily a one-to-one same thing, but what's interesting is 62% said somewhat, and only 25% said yes, and 12% said no. So I thought just a couple tidbits there that I thought we'd highlight from our survey as part of this conversation.
Continuing our conversation about the Federal Chief Financial Officer Survey for 2014, Federal News Radio's Jason Miller joining me as we discuss the results and the state of the CFO art with Marty Rubenstein, the Chief Financial Officer at the National Science Foundation.
Now, we just talked a lot about priorities. One of them was obviously dealing with budget reductions and finding efficiencies. The other big priority that came from our survey was workforce, hiring and retaining your workforce. And right behind that was improving your agency's performance through better use of financial data. I want to talk about the workforce piece for a second, because I think that's one of the biggest challenges that not just CFOs face, but every CXO faces, because of the hiring freezes that's been going on, the, we'll call it drip, drip, drip of the retirement wave versus the big whoosh of the retirement wave. But also the fact is, there's more competition for hiring good people. So from a workforce perspective, what are you doing around hiring, retaining workers, and training? Let's throw that in there too.
Well, it is a challenge. I think historically, in my experience, having been at NSF for 17 years, is that we've always had a good crop of people to select from. NSF has a good reputation. It's a fascinating mission, and it's been easy to draw people to us. More recently, however, I've seen huge groups of applicants, but they're less qualified, and our top people tend to drift off either because we're too slow in making a decision or they find something else they'd rather do. We're a much older agency than even some of the other agencies, so we do have the specter of people retiring. Specifically within the CFO organization, I think there are a couple things we're looking at. One, we really try to be creative and look at other hiring authorities. So for example, when my secretary retired, I reconstituted that position as an executive assistant. I hired somebody from the Peace Corps because you can bring them on non-competitively when they're within a year of their return to this country. And it's somebody young with a college degree who's really interested in constantly taking on more responsibility. So for him, what I do is mentor him, introduce him to interesting people in the areas that he's personally interested in, helping pay for his graduate work. And in turn, he's really taking on a lot of different interesting projects and responsibilities and helping me manage myself. So that's one thing, is looking at Peace Corps. I think also we need at NSF, at least in the CFO shop, to consider younger, lower graded people and invest in their development. We tend to hire people higher grades, with a lot more experience, which is great, but it's becoming harder to find those people. And so we're really going to need to broaden the spectrum of people that we're looking at. Training is incredibly important. First, in my organization, I've got both the accountants and the acquisition specialists, and they all require ongoing training. And I think training and development is the way you keep people interested and help move them along. And so out of my own budget, I spend over $250,000 on an annual basis, which, depending on what my bottom line is 20 to 30% of my entire discretionary budget within my organization for training. So I consider that a top priority.
That's impressive that you're spending that much on training, because you hear constantly organizations have to cut training. And then when you saw what happened with the training conferences and all that over the last couple of years with the scandals that have happened at different agencies, those budgets got even tighter and harder to get people, harder for the agency to even approve training. How have you been able to keep that budget going so they don't come to you and go, oh, your administrative budget needs to get cut? And as you said, it's been flat or going down. Let's take that training piece out.
If you mean OMB.
Not just OMB, but even your boss who says to you.
My boss, when we get our distributed discretionary funds, we're really left to manage those ourselves. And so the only time that we've had cross-agency sort of management of issues are with the conferences and travel explicitly. Other organizations may choose to spend their money on other things. Partly the travel cuts actually help with training, because if you're going to limit people on how much travel they can do and their discretionary budget hasn't been cut as much, then there is additional funds for training.
You mentioned special hiring authorities a moment ago. Do you have all of those that you would be able to use, or are there some special hiring authorities that you've thought, boy, it'd be great if I was able to do X?
I'm sure there are special authorities we'd like to have. We do have some. NSF writ large does have some special authorities, not as many as some other agencies, perhaps. But I'm not personally that involved in it, though we were having a dialogue just yesterday with Chico and people from HR about what do we do going forward. And in a sense, we asked, you know, you need to come and train us a little bit on what the latest things are coming out of OPM, because we can't keep up with all of that. And I have a senior leadership group who have decades and decades of experience and really know fundamental federal personnel issues. But there are things changing, and we don't know what the latest things are that we could be doing.
Well, you got to tell them to be listening to Federal News Radio. We talk about all the workforce changes. We have the news that counts. Is that a self plug? Is that okay?
It's shameless. It's acceptable on this program. We permit those. Have you detected any kind of dissonance or anything with, you said you're an older agency, especially in your shop, than most agencies. When you have new folks come in who maybe aren't used to the way that the federal government works and who are not used to a group of people who have a way of doing certain things, any kind of tensions is too strong a word even, but anything like that that has shown up through the work environment?
Well, I'm sitting here smiling because actually that's an ongoing issue for the National Science Foundation. You have to understand that our entire program staff are made up of PhD scientists, a large proportion of whom rotate in and out on a regular basis. So we go out and have people come and serve temporarily 2 to 4 years at the National Science Foundation from the academic institutions in this country. They are not experienced federal employees. In fact, it's sometimes hard for them to understand that they're working in a federal agency. And to be honest, I look at my organization as trying to buffer them from the reality of some of the federal rules, make sure that everything they do and everything we do is appropriate and correct, but not bring these things as problems to them, is to manage it for them. So that tension is something that is part and innate to the NSF culture and has been forever.
Let's shift gears for a second. The Data Act. So I wanted to jump into that. We talked a little bit about risk management earlier. We talked a little bit about using risk management. But Data Act is really broader. It's using data to make decisions, and it's going to influence what you do at NSF. It's going to influence how you deal with contracts, with grants, with all that data that's going to start having to flow from your agency. First of all, one of the most interesting things about the survey was we asked, are you familiar with the Data Act? And I'm happy to report 100% said, yes, we are. So that is good. Now, I said, we also asked, if you said yes, what do you think about it? And 25% said it will improve transparency. It was pretty well split. 25% said it's going to hurt my agency's decision-making ability. 25% said it will improve the government's decision-making ability, and 25% said it will hurt the government's decision-making ability, and yet 50% said we're not sure of the impact yet. So I feel obviously still early to tell. From your perspective, the Data Act, how do you implement it? What's the impact on NSF?
I think NSF is actually positioned fairly well to implement the Data Act. I think it's going to be challenging, but we have two things going for us. First, the Data Act is really spinning off of both USAspending.gov as well as a recipient reporting that came out of the Recovery Act. NSF, for one thing, is the grant and contract data that goes into USAspending comes directly out of our financial systems. For a lot of agencies and major departments, their grant system is separate from their financial system, and they're sending grant data that they're then trying to reconcile with their financial data. We don't have that situation. So our data, first, is a fairly decent quality. Second, with the recipient reporting from the Recovery Act, we have a great community who really did a very good job, both in the fact that we had 99.7% reporting levels, which is probably the highest in the government, and we very actively were out there trying to educate them on what it was they were supposed to be doing and when they had to do it. So we're used to gearing up for these things, and we think our financial data is in fairly good stead. The second thing is bringing on the new financial system. We are now having a software product that at least 20, 30, 40 other agencies have, and so when these new data elements for the Data Act are determined and the standards are set, the software company is going to have to do this for a variety of agencies, and we're not going to be in the position of the old days where we're going to have to implement it in our own system. They're going to have to do this for everyone.
Obviously good news, because when they do it, they'll do it right, and they'll do it based on a set of standards that everybody will hopefully adhere to. So more to come on that. Is the Data Act going to change from an NSF perspective a lot from what you guys do? I mean, is the requirements, is the transparency piece going to really be a big deal for you guys? Or you're already doing a lot of that already, it seems like.
I would like to think we're already doing a lot of that. All of our awards have been on our website for decades. And so sending financial data to any of these other websites, while technically we have to figure it out and try to make sure the data is good and that we're doing it appropriately, it's not going to radically change what we do or the data that we are sending out.
Is that the same for your other colleagues? Again, we talked about the CFO Council meetings, the big things that they talk about, shared services, the Data Act. Is there a lot of angst in the CFO community? Do you get that sense? And I know you can't speak for everybody else, but just sitting in those meetings, is there a lot of sighs?
Yes. No, there is angst, especially for those agencies who have yet to reconcile their USAspending data. This is like leaping forward when they would really like to clean that up and understand where their gaps are before yet another level of new data elements and other things come along that they have to support.
Wrapping up our conversation about this year's Federal Chief Financial Officer Survey with my colleague Jason Miller and Marty Rubenstein, the Chief Financial Officer at the National Science Foundation.
We talked a lot about priorities. One thing we didn't come up with, talk too much about is challenges. Now, I know your biggest challenge, your biggest priority is still the financial management system upgrade and modernization. When we asked challenges of the CFOs in our survey, hiring, training the right people was the biggest challenge. So we talked, I think, a lot about that. But one interesting thing that came out as well is the data question. So two challenges that were ranked lower on the list, but I still think important to look at, is having too much data and then having insufficient data analysis tools. One thing I'm seeing across the government as a trend is, again, the idea of data-driven decision-making and using that data in new ways, better ways to really look forward and come up with strategies. Give me a sense, NSF, how are you guys making decisions using your data?
Well, I think we'd like to think we've always been using data to make decisions. I do think that the new emphasis on it, for example, the strategic objective reviews, we really went out and inventoried the data that we have, the data we create, the data that are byproducts of what we do. And one of my major goals that I said to all the senior leaders when we went and met with them individually about the process was for to understand what data do we use and what do we not use, and can we stop making or collecting the data that's not valuable? And then, of course, there's the whole idea of then how do you present that data and what kind of dashboards do you build? I think one of the major things we've done in the last year or two is we have a new payment system. So in the past, when our grantees drew down cash from us, they drew down a lump sum that sort of covered all of the awards they had from us. Now they draw down on an award-by-award basis. So now I have that granular level of data almost in real time, which allows a program manager to go in and look and see how that award is spending vis-a-vis how is the scientific progress being made on the award. And so now they have the ability to analyze it in that framework, which we've never done before.
And you talked about dashboards, and I want to get into that in a second, but when you talk about the payment system, I think that's fascinating. So you can actually see when Grantee X, they get an award for $1 million and they take a withdrawal of $200,000. You can see, okay, now there's $800,000 left.
Absolutely.
And you get to see how they used it. Is that part of it, or is that a separate system?
That would be separate. That's in their financial system, what they actually used it for. We have a budget up front, but they're just pulling down cash against that $1 million.
And then you can, and then the program manager then can make decisions going, hey, was that really a good investment? Because for all the money that we've invested, it doesn't seem like we're getting a lot of return. I mean, I know that's not in your area.
It's more, if you're looking at true grant making in the research sector, then what you're really looking at is talking to the principal investigator about where they are on their project, what kind of progress they've made, and then looking at how much money they've spent.
That's fascinating. I think the granularity of that data is what so many people want in the contracting world, especially. I think that's the next step that they're going to. Dashboards. We hear it everywhere. Everyone has a dashboard. I'm surprised you didn't mention your stat sessions yet, but we'll go to the ACT stats, the tech stats, the portfolio stats. We could talk all day about the stat sessions. But from a dashboard perspective, what's the dashboard showing you, and how are you guys making use of that?
We're actually in the process of building one. We're calling it Award Manager, and it's really for the program managers. And again, it's going to have a variety of information on it, everything from which projects have overdue project reports to the financial data we were just discussing.
You talked about the importance of cleaning up data when we were speaking in the first part of our conversation about the transition to your new financial management system. All of these decisions that people make based off data would be all screwed up if the data is not clean and correct. When you began the process of that data cleanup, you've been doing it all along, I imagine. But when you were aware that there was some work to be done in that area, how did you know, and how did you know when your data was sufficiently clean that you were going to get good results and make good decisions based off of it? Was it a factual correcting data situation, or was it a formatting issue? Or frame that work for me.
I think it's more of a formatting issue. I think when you're looking at decades of data, that's financial data against an organization, when the structure of the organization grows and changes, then your trend data becomes difficult to align correctly. So I think part of it was that. I think a lot of it for moving data into a new financial system is really looking at things that haven't been closed out, old data or awards that still seem to be on the financial system and open and are decades old, and you don't want to carry that information to the new system. So it's tracking all down exactly what should be the situation for that particular award or that data, closing it out, putting it in the historical data, and then moving on with what's much more current.
When you come to data standardization, one thing that we've seen is contracting data, grants data, the standardization is, I would say, there, but not great. I think there's ways to get better. Is that something that you guys took into account as you were looking at which data to move over? What's the upcoming standards? What are the current standards? How did that play in the decision making?
I don't think it played really into the decision. We were really looking at what our own data looks like and just what is it that we really wanted to carry into the new system, and would it load correctly? Everything from making sure all the vendor identification was correct and would load incorrectly, all the reference data. I think what you're talking about is really something that's much more forward-looking once the Data Act's implemented. I know for a fact that with the uniform guidance that came out last year about the grants community, if you look at that, there are data standards that are defined in there, and that was the first sort of opportunity to really clarify some things. I think increasing the number of data that are standardized and then looking at the grant community with the contract community and making sure that we're calling apples apples and oranges oranges. You know, we may have an exact same definition for a particular field and call it something very different, or we may call it the same thing and use it very differently. And that work is what's really kicking off right now.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because when you talk about data cleanup, one of the hardest things is what to keep and what not to keep. Like with tax forms, right? How right. far back do you keep your taxes? Is it 10 years? Is it 20 years? As a CFO, I need some advice. So when we get off there, maybe you can help. But can you give me a sense? How did you make those decisions of what to keep?
Well, we're keeping all of it. So we're not throwing away any of the data.
Of course not. Of course not. But you may keep it in a system that's kind of
In a data repository that people, you know, once we make sure our reporting tools are up and running, you'll still have access to all that data. It's really about you're only going to move data into the new financial system that's current data that's necessary for the financial audit and for running your current portfolio. You're not going to bring all that 20-year-old data into the system because it will just bog it down.
We just have a couple of minutes left, Marty, and we've really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you very much for joining us for it. What do you see the role of the CFO looking like a year, 2 years, 5 years from now that may or may not include things that you're doing today?
It's hard for me to say what it's going to look like. I do think that it's ever-evolving, and I think there are three major things that define any CFO, because we're all somewhat different. So for example, it's the portfolio of activities that we're responsible for. So my job is not financial centric. I have grants, contracts, large science facilities, grant policy, award oversight, budget, finance. And so my portfolio is not only about finance. So CFO is almost a nickname for the fact that I'm really the head of budget, finance, and award management. I'm also the performance improvement officer, which is a whole nother group of responsibilities. So it's whatever your activities you're responsible for. It's also how is the CFO or that organization utilized by senior leadership in the agency. Sometimes it could be based on individuals, based on the value they bring, and I think that ebbs and flows. And the third thing is the use made by OMB and Treasury of the CFO Council itself. And that ebbs and flows as well. And right now, it's actually at a pretty high level, and they're very engaged with us.
What do you think would be the steps that should be taken or that you expect to see that will continue that engagement? Because I hear on an ongoing basis that you and your colleagues seem to really like that engagement. That's beneficial.
It's extremely beneficial, especially when OMB and Treasury listen and they take into account what we're saying. We've really had the last few years, I've seen a huge change and really improvement in their ability to listen to what we're saying and actually incorporate that into future guidance, what they're planning. They really are relying more on us as partners to be part of how these solutions are created and then how to implement them.
Terrific conversation. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.